Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find the new season of Here Be Monsters on August 17th at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Reptile Convention. Yes, you know, but we know what I'm talking about. Scales, fierce, slimy. These creatures are both good at night and at day. Let's talk to the people to see if they're really the best creatures for reptiles in this year.
From KCRW and the Believer magazine, this is The Organist. On today's episode, we'll hear a story about an encounter between David Bowie and David Jay, the bassist from Bauhaus, when they met on the set of the 1983 erotic horror film The Hunger. It's a really good story. We'll also hear from Kyle Mooney. And in a way, this episode is an extension of our last show, which was all about awkward performances of masculinity that play out deep in the bowels of the internet. And Kyle Mooney, who's a current cast member on SNL, mines that same territory, the land of weird dude energy that we looked at in the last episode. For The Organist, Kyle Mooney spoke to Chantal McStay, a writer and editor in New York. Hey, Chantal.
Hey, Andrew.
So, who is Kyle Mooney? Where did he come from?
Kyle Mooney is an actor, writer, and comedian from San Diego. And he got his start on YouTube alongside Dave McCary, Beck Bennett, and Nick Rutherford, who together make up the sketch group Good Neighbor. And they started posting their delightfully bizarre videos online and gained kind of a cult following, as well as the attention of Steven Spielberg and Louis C.K.
Basically, my dad was like, "You want to drop out? You have to move out." I'm like, "Fine. Fuck you, Dad. I'll just stay with Scott until Allie and I can get a place together when she goes off to college." It's like, I fucking hate my parents. Pisses me off. I'm not a caged animal. I'm not your precious little biology experiment. Time to cut off the umbilical cord, Mommy and Daddy.
I think at one point when we were talking, he mentions that the most important thing with these characters is honesty. And then at another point, he goes on to say that the one thing that they all have in common is that they're essentially lying to themselves. And I think those things are both true. I mean, I think that's kind of the perfect contradictory summation of what's so charming about them, is that the characters sort of like can't help reveal what they're most insecure about. And it comes out so fast.
Hello? Hey, what's up, little man? My little brother. Fuck. What's going on? Okay. I didn't mean to. I was just borrowing it. Okay, I'll put it back in your room. I know. Let's have Nerf battles. Okay. Thank you. I love you. You're my little man. You know that. All right. Bye. Little brother, such a fucking pussy, dude. Turns 9 years old, thinks he's a fucking badass.
Here's Kyle Mooney talking to Chantal McStay.
What do you think makes a good character?
I'd like to think, or like, I'd like my characters to be as grounded as possible. And I think it's like, especially in comedy, really easy to do characters that are slightly bigger or exaggerated. And like, I'm not here to brag, okay? But I mean, like, for instance, like, I've always liked doing like the Inside SoCal characters. And to me, that's like, could be such an easy way to just play like a stereotype bro. And I think that's what a lot of people do. But in my life, there aren't a lot of like versions of the stereotype bro that exist. Do you know what I mean? Which I can't even like, what up, man? Like, it's just like, I feel like a lot of people kind of present this cartoon when it's like, I don't know that that's true. Not to say that those people don't exist.
Yeah. But it's flatter than what you've seen.
I just feel like these people who are doing characters that are like bros, like, don't, I've actually never interacted with a bro. They just have this like kind of idea of what a bro might be.
This morning, Brian Scaleri called me and asked me if I wanted to wake and bake. I said no. And last night, Ben and Justin Kerlin asked me if I wanted to play Up the River, Down the River with them, fucking Lauren Reed and the whole Lenwood house. I didn't want to. And that's not like me, because usually I'm always down to drink, always down to smoke, always down to kick with my boys, listen to good-ass music and shit. But lately, I'm just not in the mood. Like, I don't even want to get out of bed and shit because of the overwhelming feeling of dread and sadness that clouds my entire being and keeps me from being the person who I think I should be and shit. So, I wrote this plea for help because I don't really know how to talk to my boys or my girlfriend, Bree, about these fucking crazy-ass emotions I'm feeling right now.
Do you remember the first original character that you came up with?
I mean, as a like pre-YouTube?
Sure.
When I was in sixth grade, we went to the sixth grade camp. I grew up in San Diego and like went up to the mountains for this like for like a week. It was kind of like the worst one of the worst experiences I've ever had. But I wore like it was cold and my mother had given me a jacket with a hood, with like a furry hood. I don't know what you call those. it was a snorkel coat. But I created a character named Eskimo, who is just kind of like a cute, stupid guy that like everybody in sixth grade, or rather a handful of people thought was really fun. And like Eskimo had a really big crush on this girl, Amanda, who was like, there was like at the end of the week, like a talent show and she sang. And like Eskimo was just totally in love with Amanda.
And this was a real girl in your class.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
That you really had a crush on?
No. I'm sure there was some level of being a mean kid.
Yeah. Do you have any characters that are just for you or like just for you and your friends?
That's kind of how they all start.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point, it's like, oh, maybe there's something here. Yeah, like I'll go to Disneyland or something like that with my friends and we'll just like kind of talk in a very specific voice for the entire day. And at one point in my life, I think that stuff would have just lived in that moment. But now maybe because like it is part of my job, I kind of at some point start thinking, well, maybe there's a way to stretch it out into something. But yeah, definitely. I think it all kind of, a lot of it starts out as like almost like a secret.
We both love the game so much.
I don't know what game you're talking about. What is
I'm
it?
Talking about all the athletic sports that we love, but our teams always blow it. Man, we love that stuff. Ben Jules.
What is Ben Jules? I don't know what you're talking
about. He's in charge, and he's not even at 480 yet.
What does 480 mean?
That's what the stat! How is he gonna get to round two if he's doing that? No, not my team! No!
I've always been into YouTube culture and videos, and I think, like, if you look at the stuff we were kind of making early on, we kind of always tried to present it as, like, what if this person, this character who's in the video, put out their own YouTube video? Because that's what YouTube videos are. They're like these people or kids talking to camera or not, or like capturing something and then uploading it. So like in a weird way, even the way it's presented, the title or the description, just the physical act of uploading is like also part of the character. But anyway, yeah, no, I'm both interested in like kids who have low view counts, small audiences, but kind of act as if they have the whole world watching them. So it's like, hey guys, sorry I haven't put out a video recently. But it's like, who are you apologizing to? You know, you've got like probably four people who are watching what you do, and me and my friends.
So how do you find stuff? Because obviously if you search like weird kid or
right.
whatever, then you're finding something that's already discovered, but I feel like your fascination is stuff that no one is watching.
Yeah, it's, I mean, like, I'll search terms like me and Andy doing our thing, you know what I mean? Or like Scott being an asshole, like things that are like, I don't know how to describe that. Things that like are, you would like use in dialogue with your friends or something like that. You know what I mean? Or like,
yeah.
Or like my first rap. You know what I mean?
I guess. So something they would say or
like. Yeah, there's like kind of like a weird, like maybe possessive thing about it. Like my first rap or my first vlog.
What are you doing today at SNL? Like what's Tuesday like?
Tuesday's arguably the most intense day. Usually we get in the afternoon, like 2 or 3 p.m. or around then, and then we write. Today's the writing day. So I think pieces for me are due at noon on Wednesday. So often what we'll do is like we'll work until 6 a.m., 5 a.m., and a lot of times I'll end up sleeping at the office, waking up at like 10 a.m. to then go over whatever I've written and turn it in by noon. But it's pretty grueling. And I think it's like, I think the whole night is kind of, in a weird way, like in tribute to the show that it was in the 70s. Like it's just tradition that you've like written super late into the night. I feel like other people would think it's super silly when like you could just get in at 9 a.m. potentially and like leave by like 6 p.m. But
it's not how they do it. There's a certain tradition to the schedule.
And I guess the whole job is based around late-nightedness to some degree.
Women do not get sports.
That's your unique take?
Hey, hear me out, Michael. Hear me out. I bring my girl to the ball game the other day. This is a true story, by the way. It's actually happening. The whole time she's going, who's winning, Bruce? Which team is which? Why aren't they all shopping? Pretty soon, I'm asking myself, am I watching a baseball game or solving a mystery?
That's the whole joke?
Of course, these days, they'll turn anything into a sport.
Okay.
Horse racing. You heard about this?
Yeah, man.
You seen this?
Yeah.
So this is where they put a person on top of a horse and ride around in a circle. Now, I don't know about you, Michael, but I never heard about a guy on a horse.
What? What about, like, cowboys? Okay, I'm sorry. Did you run these jokes by anybody? Like, do you have any friends that you can work this material out on first before you come on national TV?
I guess... no, I don't.
Oh, my bad, man. I'm sorry.
Right now, Kyle Mooney is in the greater Salt Lake City area shooting Brigsby Bear, which he's making with his collaborators from his sketch group Good Neighbor. It has a pretty remarkable cast, including Mark Hamill, Claire Danes, Matt Walsh, Andy Samberg, and Greg Kinnear. It'll be out next year. And now, David John Haskins, who's better known as David J. He was the bassist for the bands Bauhaus and Love and Rockets. In 1971, when David J. was still a kid growing up in central England, he heard David Bowie for the very first time. And, he tells The Organist, it was a life-altering experience that ultimately led him to a deep revelation about the thin white duke and an unmistakable harmonica line. Here's David J.
Well, I heard Bowie before I saw him. I heard there was a TV show in England called The Old Grey Whistle Test. And sometimes they would just play tracks and they would have an old movie, like an old black and white 1920s crazy movie or a Fritz the Cat cartoon or something like that. And they played this song by David Bowie called Andy Warhol.
It's Warhol, actually.
Any kind of information that you receive, be it visual or audio or text, was precious, you know. And so all I had was that album and I had the image of Bowie looking rather like Greta Garbo on the cover. And I was just intrigued by it, the androgyny of it. It's amazing. And then from then on, you know, I was totally hooked. I was a huge Bowie fan and I'd buy every album the day it came out. Posters on the wall, all that. Outraged my dad when I t- took home a copy of Aladdin, so he found me pouring over the sprayed silver centerfold of Bowie, looking even more androgynous and weird. Yes, outrage ensued. What is this? I can't tell if it's a boy or a girl. He called my mum into the room and goes, Joan, come and look at this. I've seen it all now. What, you don't like this, do you, David? I said, yes, Dad, I do. So, and he slammed it down, the cover down, and left the room in disgust. And then so I turned up the record and it sounded even better. But don't you worry about what's been on my mind. So, shooting forward, in 82, when Bauhaus were filming in London, our little area that was set up was right next to Bowie's dressing room. And in this area was a lovely old 1950s jukebox, one of those, you know, neon rainbow affairs. So I'm out there at one point, they're setting up for the next shoot. Just there on my own, and then I feel this looming presence behind me, and then this voice pipes up. Do you mind if I pick one? And I turn around, and it's Bowie. And dressed in that shark skin suit that he wears in the film with the blue shades, looking great. I said, mumbled, no, you know, be my guest, you know. So he sort of ums and ahs, and then punches 45, whatever, and it's grooving with Mr. Blow. And then he starts dancing in front of me. And it's not just like gently swaying dancing, it's full on arms above the head Bowie dance that he would do on stage. So it's so surreal. And I'm gently swaying and sort of nodding. And it's like pinch yourself time. And he keeps flashing that sensational smile. And I think it was a smile that gave me the courage to make a statement. This reminds me of something, I said to him. He goes, oh yeah, what's that? Carrying, you know, not stopping dancing, not missing a beat. I said, it's one of yours. Oh, what's that then? I said, it's off of Low. Okay. What? I said, a new career in a new town. And with that, he puts a finger to his lips, winks, smiles, and carries on dancing. So, shooting forward, right, I'm lying on my back on the bed in the Crystal Hotel in Portland, listening to the last track on his final album, and he references that same part, and it was just too much, you know. I was just overwhelmed, because it became personal then. And also, what was mind-blowing was that I realised that he, as canny as he was, he, I think, purposely referenced that because he knew he was dying. And so the new career in a new town is, the new town is the afterlife, and the new career is whatever the hell he would be doing there. I can't give everything. Everything.
David J. is the author of Who Killed Mr. Moonlight. He's currently on a solo acoustic tour of North America. He spoke to The Organist contributing editor, Jenny Amint. That story was produced by Tyler Morris. The Organist is produced by me and Ross Simonini. Our interns are Claire Boyle, Shelby El-Admani, Aaron Pelish, Zoe Kleinfeld, and Prashanth Ramakrishna. Our contributing editors are David Weinberg, Jenny Amint, and Naila Orr. Thanks to everyone at KCRW and McSweeney's. And this is the last time I'm going to mention KCRW's Radio Race, which is tomorrow. If you don't know what the Radio Race is, imagine Franca Potente from Run Lola Run, but instead of trying to get 100,000 Deutschmarks in 20 minutes, she's trying to produce a piece of radio journalism in 24 hours. It's almost too late to sign up, but not yet, so go immediately to kcrw.com/radiorace. Our website, with all of our past episodes, including the philosopher Simon Critchley's appreciation of David Bowie, is at kcrw.com/theorganist. Thanks for listening, and see you in 2 weeks.